The World Health Organization has been saying for quite some months that it strongly urges against the administration of COVID-19 booster programs in the Western world until next year in order to free up supply to vaccinate people on the continent of Africa and elsewhere. Here in Ireland, we are proceeding with a vaccination booster program, which will begin in mid-October for certain vulnerable cohorts. Trocra, which is of course headquartered in Maynooth, says this creates a moral dilemma for Ireland. Kildare Focus producer Ciarán Noble has been speaking to Chief Executive of Trocra, Caoimhe de Barra.
Dr. Colm Henry, the HSE's Chief Clinical Officer, said on Thursday, only time will tell if everyone in Ireland will need a booster vaccine. By the end of this week, the country is to reach the milestone of administering 7 million vaccines. We're going to take a quick look at some of the countries around the world in terms of the amount of people that are vaccinated and the population rate of that country that's fully vaccinated. We'll take India. 170 million people are fully vaccinated. That's only 12.5% of the population. Vietnam, 3.77 million people fully vaccinated, 3.9% of the entire population. Nigeria, 1.58 million fully vaccinated. That's 0.8% of that population. You look at Uganda, 242,000, 0.5% of the population fully vaccinated. Afghanistan, 431,000, 1.1% of the population vaccinated. South Sudan, 6,718 people are fully vaccinated, 0.1% of the population. Then you look at Ireland. We have 3.48 million citizens in this country fully vaccinated from COVID-19, 71.0% of our population. Gibraltar, much smaller place, 39,270 people there are fully vaccinated. That's greater than 99% of the adults. And we know more than 90% of Irish adults have now been vaccinated. But does this country and others in the first world have a question of morality to answer? Well, the charity Trocra thinks so, and the chief executive, Caoimhe de Barra, joins me this afternoon. Hi, Caoimhe.
Hello, how are you?
Very stark figures there.
These are very stark figures indeed, and this has been well declared by the World Health Organization, which for at least 9 months, if not a year, has been talking about the real risk to everyone globally around the slow pace of vaccination in poorer countries. And we will see this playing out, unfortunately, in the continued development of new variants, which will create problems for us here in a country which has had tremendous success in its vaccine rollout. But we remain at risk because the whole world is vaccinated to a very low extent. The figures that you mentioned there are very, very stark. Trocra works in South Sudan. We work in many of the countries that you mentioned. And not only are the rates of vaccination low, but the health systems to respond to people who get the virus are incredibly fragile. So to give you one example, in just one of the countries that Trocra works in, 50% of our staff, who are local staff, have had COVID, and many have been very, very ill. Many of their family members have had COVID. Many have lost family members. Not only do they not have access to vaccines, but when they get ill, they don't have access to the basic supports that are needed to preserve life, including oxygen. So the fragility of health systems and the lack of vaccines are meaning that many people are losing their lives unnecessarily, and we need as a global community to reach people, first of all, with an increased production level of vaccines. So this is a moment where we do need to consider what is our response to the world, as well as the responsibility to those most vulnerable in our own communities.
Doesn't this go back to human nature, Caoimhe? You can get used to anything, you can accept anything if it, I guess, is normality to you. And we know, as a society here in Ireland, we're a first world country. We know others are first world countries. We give out about our own health services. We can look at continents like Africa and really note poor health services in those countries for obvious reasons. But yet, we're able to go to bed at night, sleep, knowing that we can throw out our maybe, you know, quarter of our dinner each night when somebody else can't even feed themselves for, you know, one day out of the week. Isn't it just human nature that we seem to just be able to accept this?
I actually think that there's a huge level of empathy and understanding amongst the Irish population for people who are affected by issues such as conflict, climate change and now COVID. And actually what we see is that popular opinion on things like vaccination and making sure that people in developing countries have access to vaccines, on issues like overseas development assistance, that actually people are ahead of political opinion on this. In surveys that are carried out, for example, for DOHUS, which is an umbrella body of development and humanitarian NGOs, it finds that the vast majority of people actually want the Irish government to do more in terms of overseas spending on issues that affect people in developing countries, including health and education. So I think people are very aware, first of all, that the rate of vaccination globally affects our safety here in Ireland and want to see us doing even more. And Ireland is a country that has stepped up. We do have a moral standing globally, and we can see that in the performance that we have on the UN Security Council, which is very positive. But we also have leverage in terms of our membership of the European Union, in terms of being on the UN Security Council, to influence other larger states to, number one, increase the production of vaccines, to increase the availability of vaccines, to increase the investment in the health services of poorer countries in order to make sure that more people are vaccinated as soon as possible.
Caoimhe, we know that inflation has risen in this country. Everything is more expensive than it once was. We know that we have had a pandemic. Some people have lost their jobs. Others haven't. In general, we have saved in 2020, I think it was about 10 billion euro as an Irish society. How do charities like Trócaire look at those figures? And I guess it isn't a blame game, me asking you that. It's just out of interest. Because when first world countries are able to save so much money in the midst of a pandemic, it does take you aback and you sit and think to yourself, wow, just how unjust the world is.
Very unequal and a very unjust place. And this plays out in ways which are stark and shocking at a human level and at a macro level. So, for example, in the 20 years up until 2020, we collectively as a world had managed to reduce extreme poverty to a very significant degree. Extreme global poverty fell every year in the 20 years to 2020, and then it rose by over 100 million in 2020. And it will rise by another 100 million as a direct result of climate impact in the next 10 years. So what that shows is that as a world, as a global community, we have the wherewithal, we have the creativity, the ingenuity, the technology, the resources to radically reduce poverty globally. It requires an intentional approach. What I have seen personally observing this as the leader of a large Irish charity in the development field is that over the past year and a half, people want change. Individuals phone us up and they send letters and they send emails. They're saying, look, I have a little bit of extra money. I don't have a lot, but I know that you can do a lot with it and I would like to donate it to you. People also want the government to use the tax that we pay as taxpayers wisely, which includes using it to support people in developing countries who are facing horrendous realities of failures of health systems to be able to provide even the most basic protection to them. So people want our government to continue to commit more strongly than ever, now more than ever, to the people who are, you know, our common humanity, our brothers and sisters, in fact, in other countries. So I think there's a question of the popular will is there, and we need to make sure that the political will is there. And that will be mobilised by people being in contact with their political representatives and saying, look, I know all of these local issues are important, but I really want you to as well.
You broke up a little bit there. We did hear most of it, though. You mentioned that Irish people are very charitable. We know as a country we faced a lot, and I think we have great empathy and compassion for others. But day to day, our listeners, what can they do right now to help in these situations?
So people listening to this, they can donate to charities like Trócaire. We use money incredibly effectively and we make it go an awful long way. So that is one practical thing that people can do. People can also contact their local political representative and ask them in the run up to the budget, which will be announced in early October, to really work hard to make sure that we fulfil the international, moral and also economic obligations on us. Because if we let the global economy fail as a result of COVID and the impact of climate, that will affect us too. It'll affect jobs in Ireland. So asking people to contact your local TD and make it clear to them that you care about the impact of COVID and climate change on developing countries, and you want Ireland to maintain or increase its overseas aid programme. That's another practical thing that people can do, I think, that demonstrates solidarity.
Well, Chief Executive of TROCRA, Caoimhe de Barra, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
And thank you indeed to Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Now, the total volume of packaging waste generated in Ireland rose by 11% in 2019. That was also the third successive year in which over 1 million tonnes was generated. That's according to the Environmental Protection Agency. I'm joined on the line now by senior scientist in the EPA's waste statistics team, Tara Higgins. Tara, you're very welcome to the programme. Our generation of over 1.1 million tonnes of packaging waste sounds, in laypersons and in household, individual household terms, to be absolutely vast. Is it on par per head of population with our counterparts across Europe?
Well, Ciara, as you said, we generated over 1.1 million tonnes of packaging waste in 2019. And just to put into context, that's about 43,000 bin trucks full of just packaging waste. It has shown an increase. We've seen a general trend of increasing packaging waste generation across Europe. It tends to follow, packaging waste tends to follow general economic trends. So as incomes and as the economic activity goes up, packaging tends to go up also. But Ireland has very high packaging waste generation figures. And the second, I suppose, worrying trend that we highlighted today in our figures just released is that our recycling rates are showing a worrying decline. So overall, we're recycling now 62% of packaging. That's crept down in the last few years from 64% the previous year. And we're also seeing particularly a worrying trend for plastic packaging, less than a third, only 28% of our plastic packaging was recycled, and the rest, the 70% remaining, went for incineration. So, yeah, the figures highlight, you know, that there are problems that we need to tackle both on the generation side and also on our recycling.
And if those were the figures, Tara, for 2019, I shudder to think what they're going to be like for 2020, because we had a massive boom in online shopping. And we all know, anybody who has bought even the most minor of items online, that it comes laden down with packaging and then generating more waste ostensibly than if you'd walked to the corner shop and were able to buy that same item.
Absolutely. I mean, everyone can relate to this in the last year, and even if doing your weekly grocery shop or, as you said, online sales, there's a huge amount of packaging, and that gets really to the heart of it. Ultimately, what we need to do to tackle this problem is to massively reduce the amount of packaging that producers, that retailers and that industry are placing on the market in the first place. You know, we do need to tackle the recycling, and consumers really do need to play their part and segregate the waste correctly. But ultimately, to address the trends and to really get the environmental and the climate benefits, we need to just cut down on, as you said, much of the packaging is excessive or unnecessary. And then we also need to make sure that what is necessary and what does remain in terms of packaging is fully recyclable. And I suppose some good news is that there are measures in train to tackle these issues. You know, by 2030, all packaging placed on the market in Ireland and across Europe must be fully recyclable or reusable. And so, you know, there's light on the horizon in terms of that. But in the meantime, you know, we need retailers and industry to really start now addressing this problem and looking at the amount of packaging that they place on the market.
I always wonder why producers, and clearly this would be item specific and sector specific, but seem to be so married to the notion of excess packaging. It costs them money and it creates consternation and hassle for the consumer.
Yes, and I suppose really as part of the kind of the new policy, the circular economy and the European Green Deal, it's getting to that. It's incentivizing industry to design out, to look at the design stage and to design out excessive packaging and to look at how goods are delivered to shop shelves or how they're transported along the transport chain to make sure that, you know, alternatives, for example, you know, we've seen a huge growth in shrink wrap, and it's been cheap and it's been easy for manufacturers to use these types of products. But ultimately, you know, they're not easily recyclable. And so things like reusable crates that can just as easily deliver products to shop shelves, and there's loads of other examples. It's really about rethinking, you know, the system and addressing it, you know, in that way.
On the behavioural side in households up and down the country, Tara, do you have any sense as to why recycling rates have dropped?
So we do know that there's a couple of factors at play there. On the one hand, you know, up until now and up until the recent announcement this week, soft plastics, and that's things like the lightweight clings and wraps that are so prevalent now across, you know, like all a lot of fresh fruit and veg come with these lightweight plastic wraps. These weren't accepted in the recycling bins in Ireland in any household or commercial settings up until now. Now they are, because the industry is able to now separate what, through the use of sorting technology, what can and can't be recycled. So that will improve that somewhat. But also another factor is simply, you know, recycling behaviours and behaviours in households and in commercial settings, where we found that even obviously recyclable products like aluminium cans and like, you know, plastic bottles that are completely high value recyclable products that are easily, you know, easy to wash out and easy to put in a recycling bin. We found in a lot of that is still ending up in the black bin and then by extension ending up in incinerated. So we've figures that show that about 13,000 tonnes of aluminium was incinerated in 2019. And there really is no reason for that other than poor segregation and poor separation. And that's a behavioural element. And similarly, about 40,000 tonnes of the really easily, readily recyclable plastic, like the plastic bottles. So, you know, it's addressing it, I suppose, on multiple fronts. The industry do have a part to play. Producers have a part to play. Retailers and also citizens and households.
Well, Tara Higgins, senior scientist in the EPA's waste statistics team, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the struggle for some students of finding accommodation at Maynooth University in advance of the beginning of the new academic year. And we will hear about tomorrow's Donaghy 9/11 memorial. There's a big scramble on in Maynooth and I suppose North Kildare generally for accommodation for some students just in advance of the result of the academic year, which is just around the corner. Joined on the line now to discuss this by Kildare North Sinn Féin TD, Raida Cronin. Raida, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara. Good afternoon.
This is always going to be a tough time for students and their families because of the state of the housing and rental crisis in general. But for students, it can be particularly tough because they can't live where they want. You or I may elect to commute. Students in general, in order to make it work, need to live close to their place of education. What are you hearing from students hoping to attend Maynooth University this semester?
Yes, you're right, Ciara. And this year, more than ever, it's very important for students that they get accommodation close to, you know, in Maynooth, because, you know, people from down the country who there mightn't be great public transport links and they haven't been able to get their driving license, their driving test. So that's not an option. So, yeah, that we're absolutely in the middle of an accommodation crisis in Maynooth, in North Kildare, all over. But it's very hard for these young people who, you know, have seriously curtailed their lives, you know, due to COVID, and they've had very little thanks for it. And they've had two extremely stressful academic years, whether they're first years, they've experienced two academic years in secondary school, or if their second or their third years, they've experienced an extremely stressful academic year in Maynooth last year and the year prior to that. So they really are very stressed out. And I have parents on the phone to me as well, like almost in tears at the situation that they're facing and the prices that they're seeing if they can get accommodation. But generally, they just aren't able to get accommodation. And I think that with the... I will be raising this with Minister Harris, you know, the absence of appropriate accommodation for our students in Maynooth. But I think I'd also like to talk if there are any people locally in Maynooth who might consider taking a student into Diggs, in case they haven't thought about that before, if they're nervous of the COVID situation and the high numbers, perhaps they could get in touch with the student services office in Maynooth. I do have an email if anybody around Maynooth has a room that they would be willing to give up student.services@mu.ie if they would get in touch with that, because I think, you know, our population in Maynooth doubles during the academic year when the Maynooth University is up and running. But we absorb those into our community very, very well, and they fit in so well, and they are an important part of our community. And you know, I think we really have to do our best, pull out all the stops now to see if we can get accommodation for these families and these young students.
What I always think about a situation like this, Raidan, and it's replicated in the vicinity of every third level institution of any kind right across the country, is that families are so desperate to find not even suitable accommodation, not even affordable accommodation, just accommodation, that they're really, really vulnerable to scams. They're also being vulnerable to price gouge just to get a roof over their child's head.
And we have that all the time. And last year, landlords who particularly rent out to students, you know, over the last year, they might have given their homes to families. And, you know, that was great last year where we were looking for accommodation for families and that around the North Kildare area. It has left us in a situation where there's less accommodation available now for students. And the university itself, I think it only hosts around 900 student accommodation on the campus. And that really isn't enough. You know, Maynooth University is going to have to step up to the plate. And if there's more help needed, Simon Harris is going to have to ensure that universities all over the country, all over the state, really come up with proper student accommodation on campus. Because I know that in Maynooth University, they generally keep the vast majority of those four first-year students, understandably, who are leaving home and you know, aren't familiar with the town, or, you know, just want to get on campus accommodation the first year. Some of them might be only 17, 18 going to university for the first time. But it is a huge problem.
Absolutely. And just as an aside, Maynooth University and NUI Galway, I think, are among a hen's teeth vanishingly small number of third level institutions that have not increased their fees this year. Labour Councillor Angela Feeney has gotten in touch saying that there is a planning application into Kildare County Council for 125 student bed accommodation in the general vicinity of Maynooth. And should that be granted planning permission, Raida, it'll be 18 months before that's ready.
Exactly. So, you know, we are at this stage now that we are where we are, as they say. But, you know, Maynooth University does need to provide more on-campus accommodation. 125 units will be welcome, but it really is only the tip of the iceberg what's needed.
Now, on to matters slightly different. The Sinn Féin motion of no confidence in Simon Coveney has been topping news bulletins for the entire day. And the Taoiseach, who is, of course, leader of Fine Gael, of which Simon Coveney is a part, has just issued a statement, Raida. He says that this no confidence motion is a stunt, and he says Sinn Féin is throwing mud in the hope some of it sticks. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think here we have to be clear about what this is about. It's about power and influence and the actions of ministers and how they behave on behalf of the state. And that's what the people who are listening to this, the absolute arrogance of Fine Gael and expecting Fianna Fáil to take the, you know, to all line up now and vote confidence in a minister that they have so many have expressed that they have no confidence. They have no confidence in the answers he gave to committees. This is about ministers and how they behave in office with jobs, official information and official record keeping. And Minister Coveney has not kept, complied with FOI. And, you know, I think everybody at home, they want the government to work for them. This isn't about pulling a fast one. Fine Gael tried to pull a fast one on the Taoiseach on this appointment that they were working behind the scenes on for 4 months. You know, Fine Gael have been in power too long in this country. It's no coincidence. Fine Gael never had more than one term in office until the last time, and that was because Fine Gael have fallen on their faces. But you know, this is about this palace mentality they have. Privilege and entitlement and jobs for the girls, jobs for the boys. They say that familiarity breeds contempt, but, you know, it's Fine Gael are showing contempt for the people. They're pretending now that they'd like to be going in there talking about housing and homelessness and health. while they have been squandering billions, squeezing ordinary people out of being able to afford housing, you know, healthcare, decent healthcare. And Leo Varadkar can be throwing as much mud as he wants at Sinn Féin, but if the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste aren't able to keep their ministers, you know, to hold them to account, you know, it's up to Sinn Féin to do it as the lead.
Rita, Simon Coveney has apologised twice before the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs and Defence. The Taoiseach has already said he will not sack him and that doing so would be disproportionate in terms of the framing of this controversy. Is the tabling of this motion then just to make a point?
Well, it's not to make a point. This is about power and influence. It's about how people treat the offices of the state. This isn't just about, you know, it's an absolute privilege to be an elected member, and it would be an absolute privilege to be in government in this state. And it's not meant to be used to just look after your friends in high places and power and privilege. It's about the offices of the state being respected. The office of Taoiseach wasn't respected. It's not about the personalities here. It's about how the state works and how the state works for its people and being held to a proper account, to a high account.
Rita Cronin, Sinn Féin TD in Kildare North, thank you indeed for joining us. WhatsApp in to us 0833 97 97 97. WhatsApper wants to find out a very special song that Clem played on Tuesday morning, and the texter says their granddad loved it but they can't find it was a male singer. You leave that with me and we'll find out that information for you.
Want to get in touch with your favourite show on KFM? Text or WhatsApp us now on 0833 97 97 97.
Keynote commemoration will take place at Donaghadee Forest Park tomorrow afternoon. I'm joined on the line now by Peter Cunningham. He's an author and a member of the Donaghadee 9/11 Committee. Peter, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Peter, can you outline for people maybe who aren't familiar with this annual event why it takes place and specifically why it takes place in Donaghadee Forest Park?
Yeah, sure, Ciara. Well, this is one of those rare stories that's both heartbreaking and really inspirational, because back in the 80s you had the Tallon family who come from Donaghadee, and they had a son, Paddy Tallon had a son, Sean Tallon. And he, as a little boy, he went to school in Kilcock. But in 1982, when Sean was 8, the family emigrated to New York, to Yonkers. And leaving his mother, Rose Tallon, behind and other extended family members. So Sean, who had, as a little boy, grown up in Donaghadee, and had, because his granny lived in Mount Armstrong, his granny Rose lived in Mount Armstrong, which is just backs on to Donaghadee Forest Park. And he had played in the park, and he now lived in New York. And he went on to go to university. He joined the Marine Corps, and in 2020 he joined the Fire Department in New York. And the family came back every year. They were very much attached to the Donaghadee area. They came back, and he was very close to his grandmother, Rose. And in fact, in 2001, in late August, he was in Donaghadee, and he returned to New York to his job in the Fire Department of New York. And as it so happens, he was a rookie firefighter at that stage. He's only been 11 months in the job, and he was assigned to Ladder 10, which is directly opposite the Twin Towers.
And on that fateful day, Sean was one of those first responders who attempted to save as many lives as is possible.
Indeed, he was. Indeed, he was. And it was. I mean, that is the heartbreaking part of it. That is that he. His father, and his parents out in Yonkers, like the rest of the world, were certainly becoming aware of what was going on the television, like everybody all over the world was at that time. And Paddy, his father, who said, Sean is in there. He could just watch the whole thing happening in real time. And it's heartbreaking to think a parent, many, many parents who had sons and daughters were in a similar situation, must have thought. And Sean went into the North Tower and he never came out.
It's hard to imagine the horror of any parent or any loved one watching their family member on that day, because it was one of the first atrocities of its kind that was effectively broadcast live on rolling news, and the world was gripped by it.
Absolutely. The whole world was watching in horror. But can you imagine the horror for a parent knowing that his son, who was stationed in the fire station, who was stationed in the fire department immediately opposite the Twin Towers, was certain to be in there.
Very shortly thereafter, the people of Donaghadee, including yourself, came together to form the 9/11 Donaghadee Memorial Committee. And I know a very, very dignified memorial was erected in the Forest Park in 2003, containing hundreds of names. Can you talk us through how that memorial came to be designed and erected, and who is memorialised therein?
Sure. So the so as you say, we came together. And the memorial which went up in Donaghadee Forest Park is unique. It remembers by name the 343 firefighters, 23 police officers and 36 port authority officials who lost their lives on that day. And it's a very dignified and a beautiful monument to their bravery. It consists of a striking scaled replica of the Twin Towers, carved. It's carved from Irish limestone, and sung by our local sculptor Bernard Groom. And the committee then, chaired by Michael Fitzpatrick, the late TD, such people as Morna Hosey, who's a local community advocate, George Hipwell, Sean Flannery, Liam Holton, many, many other people who were involved in the committee that saw bringing it to Donaghadee, saw the monument coming to Donaghadee, and it's a most beautifully tranquil place. And you go there in the early morning, as I do very frequently on my bicycle, cycle around the lake, and you come back up to the monument, and it's just so dignified and just so evocative to think that it makes you proud to think of what actually happened that day, the response by these incredibly brave people.
And it is at that site, Peter, that tomorrow a very special staging of the annual memorial will take place to mark 20 years. It begins at 3 o'clock, and it's a very nuanced ceremony.
It is, and you have representatives of the various services there, and you have it's an ecumenical service. It is going to be music, poetry, readings. It'll be quite a low key, but dignified, as in keeping with the place and the event, and or in keeping with the people that it commemorates. An interesting kind of an also touching, really touching sort of other detail of that. As I said, Sean Tallon had been home to visit his grandmother, Rose Tallon Donaghadee, in 2001, just before he returned to New York. And 7 years later, in 2008, on the 11th of September, his grandmother passed away.
Oh, God.
So, in fact, tomorrow, 9/11, is the anniversary not just of Sean, not just of all the people who died in 9/11, but also of Mrs. Tallon.
And is tomorrow's memorial, Peter, open to members of the public?
It is indeed.
And at what location in the Forest Park will it take place?
So the entrance to the event is through the car park in Donaghadee Forest Park. You go in, you park, then you walk down, and it's well signposted down to where the 9/11 memorial is situated.
Peter Cunningham, author and a key member of the 9/11 Donaghadee Committee. Thank you indeed for your time.
Thank you.
Texter who wanted to know the name of the song that Clem played just after 10 o'clock on Wednesday's edition of Kildare Today because their granddad loved it. The song is Dance in the Old Fashioned Way by Charles Aznavour. So that's Dance in the Old Fashioned Way by Charles Aznavour. Teresa has just sent us in an absolutely lovely text. And Teresa, I have to in advance say thank you for your kindness and your faith. And it says, hi, Ciara, you're a wonderful presenter on the radio and I think you would be the perfect Kildare manager. I'd want to get a wriggle on if I'm going to get my application in by 5 o'clock next Friday, as that's the closing date. But thank you again, Teresa. And Teresa is texting us on 0833 97 97 97 from Kilcullen. Speaking of matters GAA.
So tomorrow at 5 o'clock, it's the throw-in of the 2021 All-Ireland Senior Football Men's Final. Dublin, do you hear me? I'm just so used to saying it now. It's Mayo and Tyrone. They're taking on each other. And a lot of people around the country, no matter where you're from, are going to be supporting Mayo for obvious reasons. It's been 70 years since that county has lifted the Sam Maguire. And people have a lot of, I guess, a lot of ideas as to why this is so. There is a curse that is spoken about, but to discuss this with me, I have Dr. Arlene Crampsey of UCD joining us. And Dr. Crampsey, is this curse real?
I don't think so. And I've spent a lot of time looking into the details of this curse over the last couple of years, and I can't find any serious evidence for it. But it's certainly a very good story, and we love a good story or a good yarn in this country. So you can see why it's so popular and why it's grown legs over the last couple of years.
I mean, we do love a good story. You're totally right there. I myself was speaking about it a few weeks ago with my colleague on our morning current affairs show, and I was noting that a friend of mine from Mayo was speaking about the fact that there's two members of the 1951 team still alive. Supposedly now there's only one member of that team still alive.
And yeah,
I'm sure it's not very nice for him to hear this sort of talk that goes on, that this priest supposedly cursed the team back in 51 because they had overtaken a funeral, I believe it was.
Yeah, so there's different versions of the curse story that circulate. But yeah, there's only one surviving member of the 1951 team left. And it's interesting this year. I can see a lot of responses from Mayo saying, look, this is actually really disrespectful to the remaining members of the 51 team and to the deceased members of the 51 team. Like, they were great players. They'd won back-to-back All-Ireland in 1950 and 1951. And yet their legacy has been tarnished by this kind of curse story. And the kind of the popular version that there seems to be is that they were on their way back from an All-Ireland from the All-Ireland final, and as part of their homecoming celebrations, they were disrespectful passing a funeral in the town of Foxford. And that's kind of the thread that's common to all the stories. And then it varies then between whether it was a priest or the widow or a witch who cast a curse on the team and said that the team would never win another All-Ireland until the last remaining member of the team had passed away.
Well, look, in terms of tomorrow afternoon, we won't know until we actually get there if Mayo will lift the Sam Maguire after the 70 years. You yourself, I know, are from Donegal. Who will you be supporting tomorrow?
I am torn allegiances for this one, I have to say. I'm a proud Ulster woman, and I normally support an Ulster team when they're playing people from anywhere else, but I've been so invested in following this Mayo story over the last couple of years that I think my heart's probably saying Mayo for this one.
It's going to be fascinating. I think everybody across the country is very excited, and it's nice to see, you know, the two teams, Tyrone and Mayo, in the final, and the Dubs being knocked out. It's good to see different competition. Obviously, over
here, unique one.
A unique one. We're hoping for Kildare next year, Arlene. Fingers
yes,
crossed.
Well, there's all kinds of rumours about Kildare curses starting to surface as well, so you can look into that one a bit more deeply for next year.
And tell me, have you got any updates on those curses for us?
No, and I haven't looked into it in enough detail, but I did spot a couple of people saying that there was a similar story to the Mayo one circulating in Kildare, because obviously it's been a while for yourselves as well.
It has been a while. You don't have to rub it in. We remember. yes, it has been a while. Okay. We're going to have to look that up, Arlene, and hopefully we'll get back to you. You'll have more updates for us. I'm going to have a little look at that over the next couple of hours and come back and see if I can have any more updates for our listeners. Thank you so much, Dr. Arlene Crampsey. She is of UCD, lecturer and assistant professor in the School of Geography there. Have a great weekend, and Mayo for Sam.
Thanks a million. Bye.
And that was, of course, Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Now, more than 60% of children say they've been contacted by a stranger through an online game. That's according to CyberSafe Kids, which has found that a third of children aged 8 to 12 have friends or followers on social media that they don't know in real life. And a third of children reported seeing something online that upset or scared them. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Chief Executive and co-founder Alex Cooney. Alex, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
These data, these statistics when taken in the round, kind of really point firmly to the fact that there are an awful lot of quite young children who have unfettered online access.
Yeah, this is based on quite a large sample of children. So almost 4,000 children we surveyed over the last academic year. And I think we can confidently say that they have certainly a reasonable amount of access to the online world, but most of them have devices. So we found 93% of them owned their own smart device, be it a games console, a tablet or a smartphone. 84% of them had their own social media or messaging, instant messaging accounts. I think this data points to the fact that they are absolutely largely active in the online world.
And but the key point, the crux of the matter is there that many of them, certainly not all, certainly by no means not all, have unsupervised, unlimited access to the online world.
Yeah, so we found that about 13% of children told us that they have no rules in place at all. So we have a section of our survey that tries to kind of understand what rules might be in place at home. And then 30% of children said that they could go online whenever they wanted. 80% of children indicated that they were allowed to play in their devices in their bedrooms. And, you know, so for sure, there is definitely more we can be doing in terms of putting good rules and good boundaries in place, especially for children when they are in this younger age group. They do need parental guidance and support. They do need to be supervised. There do need to be regular conversations. There does need to be regular conversations. So, you know, a really important parental role here.
In your view, Alex, why are those conversations not taking place in many households? Why is that guidance and that oversight not in place in many households?
I mean, I think if you look at the last 18 months that we've had, it has been really challenging. You know, you've got children at home all day during periods of time, so 3 months at a time, where they were homeschooling. Their normal social channels were severely limited. Their normal activities outdoors were limited. So I think it pushed a lot of us online. It pushed children online. Parents were often trying to work from home. There's no question that being on devices does keep children kind of busy and quieter. And, you know, there's lots of positives for them being online. And I think it's really important that we do have that balanced conversation and recognize the positives. And also on the positives, we did find in our report that when we asked children about how regularly they talk to parents, we are seeing improvements there. You know, we are seeing that number increase of children reporting that they do speak to their parents about online safety with reasonable regularity. So there are some positives certainly coming out of this report. But yes, it's clear that that obviously children have great access to the online world. They love it. You know, online gaming was hugely popular. About 80% of the children told us that they were gaming online. Lots of them on social media. A third of them posting videos of themselves online. And it is, again, it's just really important that they're doing so under the watchful eye of their parents and carers.
And what are the barriers, Alex, as you see it, to the having of those conversations on a frequent basis in households, to the putting in place of perhaps tech fixes to limit the amount of time a child spends online, to include safe searches, etc., on whatever devices are available to them?
So I think some parents feel maybe a little out of step. They don't feel that tech savvy themselves. Their children seem to know more than they do. I don't know that there's always the recognition that devices, are not toys. You know, that they do require this ongoing responsibility, this ongoing oversight. I think that, so yeah, in terms of parental controls, I think sometimes parents just aren't aware and think it's complicated to apply them. And actually, a simple Google search will tell you very easily how you can apply parental controls at device level, at app level, at network level.
You know, so I think we just need to use the information that's out there. If you think of any other aspect of parenting, you know, teaching our kids to cross the road or ride a bike safely, there is a process that we go through as parents that we prepare our kids. We use the things that to help make it safer, like the training wheels, the helmets. We take them to parks so that they can ride safely. You know, when we introduce them to the roads, we're there alongside them. And, you know, we're having constant conversations, look left, look right, make sure you're listening out, you know, all of these things. And it's about preparing them for that time when they will be going out on their own on the road and hoping that we have prepared them well enough to have mitigated against the risks that there are. You know, it's the same with the online parenting. You know, we need to prepare children. We need to equip them with the skills. They don't, you know, they may very well be fluent in terms of finding their way around technology, but they're also naive, and they need support to be able to spot things like, you know, fake news, that people might not always be who they say they are. You know, we need children to be critical thinkers online, to be really questioning everything they're coming across online.
And the reality is that eight-year-olds really don't engage in critical thinking in any sphere of their life to any great degree. So to expect them to be able to do so when they're online and exposed to information for which they're not yet emotionally mature enough to encounter in many ways, or to interact with strangers, and you let them do so unfettered, it in some ways it beggars belief.
I mean, we don't hand over an adult bike to a child and say, off you go. We don't give them the keys to a car. You know, there's lots of good reasons. There's a preparation piece that needs to happen. And it can take a good period of time, you know, until we're confident that they're ready to do these things. So we need to start thinking the same way for the online world. Much of the online world was not designed with children in mind. And I think we have to have that awareness, you know, that if we don't put things in place. So, for example, Safe Search, which you mentioned earlier, you know, this is just a simple way to block out or to filter out some of the more adult content from a search engine, you know, so that you can trust that while your children are Googling stuff or whatever search engine you're using, that some of that more inappropriate content is going to be filtered out. You know, there are simple measures that we can put in place. We do need to recognize that they have tremendous access to, you know, pretty much any information. You know, there was a study back in 2016 by the NSPCC in the UK of children accessing porn, and it was looking at 11 to 16-year-olds. It was quite an extensive survey of 1,000 children, and they found that about half of them had come across porn. By the age of 14, the ones that had seen porn, you know, most of them had seen it, 90%+ had seen it by the age of 14. And some of them had gone looking for it, but many of them had just stumbled across it, you know, looking for something else. So I think we've got to have that awareness of what's out there.
Alex Cooney, CEO and co-founder of CyberSafe Kids.